Football Weekly is on the air.
Here's the snap.
Drops back. Throws the ball. The long ball downfield.
Down the line. Breaks the tackle. He's still going. 50, 45,
40, 30.
He's getting the ball away.
Runs left to the 20, to the 10, to the 5.
And he sprints into the end zone. Touchdown!
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 This is Wayne Larrabee along with Hub and Arthur Arkush. Welcome to Pro Football Weekly, an in-depth look at professional football this week. Coming up, divisional playoff weekend, Denver and Peyton looking to avoid another first-round ouster.
Does anyone want to coach the Cleveland Browns? And what is the NFL doing about the major officiating problems they have on their hands?
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Welcome to our divisional playoff edition of Pro Football Weekly. This is Wayne Larrabee. Hub Arkush is on assignment and joining us on the phone today. Arthur Arkush of USA Today is with us in studio. And guys, let's start the way we hear it with this Cleveland job opening that's going on right now. I know the Browns have interviewed several people, including Ben McAdoo, the Green Bay Packers quarterbacks coach. But are they having trouble, Hub, selling top candidates on this job after Josh McDaniels withdrew?
You know, Wayne, it's beginning to appear that way. Josh McDaniels meeting with the Cleveland Browns owner, Jimmy Haslam, and Joe Banner, the head of football operations, was described as going very well, very cordial. The two sides seemed to hit it off. And then shortly after the meeting, McDaniels withdrew himself from consideration. Now, it is quite possible that McDaniels sensed that he wasn't going to get the job, and so wanted to be known as somebody who withdrew rather than was not chosen. But at the end of the day, there's other candidates, one or two who elected not to even interview, several who've spoken to them and decided it wasn't right for them. The way that Bob Chudzinski was handled, the release after 1 year, and the fact that he had two highly respected veteran coordinators in Norv Turner and Ray Horton who were very, very unhappy with the situation, sets up a situation for the owner and the guy in charge of football operations, Arthur, where some top coaches are saying, hey, I don't want to go somewhere where I can't really trust what I'm being told.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the Browns organization has really been the picture, a model of inconsistency with regard to the head coaching position. You know, they just filter through them, it seems, every year, every other year. And, you know, I think they may be two exclusive issues, but in Josh McDaniels' case, I think he realized that, you know, it's going to be eventually his second head coaching opportunity. Obviously, he fizzled out in Denver. He wants it to be perfect. I can't really fault him for that. He sees these guys, you know, heading to the chopping block year in and year out. A lot of guys don't get a third chance in the NFL as head coaches. So, you know, there are some things to like here in Cleveland. There's a nice nucleus. There's some really, you know, some talent on both sides of the ball. But, of course, they don't have the quarterback position figured out. And, you know, some would say that they have some people at the top who are meddling a little more than usual. Jimmy Haslam has been rumored to have been very, very much involved in the interview process, which, of course, he would be. But you don't want to get into one of these situations where the owners is kind of getting too involved in something you have to always be looking over your back for.
You know, the other thing, guys, and correct me if I'm wrong, they've got a couple of first-round draft choices. They're loaded up for the draft and maybe in a position where they can maneuver to get one of the top quarterbacks in this draft coming up. Is that true, Hub?
It is. They've got their own pick, and of course they've got the Indianapolis Colts pick with the Trent Richardson trade made early in the 2013 season. The issue there, Wayne, is that while people were talking about this being another draft of quarterbacks, so to speak, going into the college season, it's turned out to not necessarily be the case. There are some first-round picks, no question about that. The kid everybody knows the least about, Brent Bortles out of Central Florida, looks like he may be the best prospect, assuming he's in this draft. But at the end of the day, even with the two first-round picks, there's no guarantee the quarterback of the future is there, unlike the last couple of years where people couldn't wait to get their hands on an Andrew Luck or an RG3.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to another topic, fellas. $765 million settlement of the players' class action suit that was filed against the NFL, and that's the settlement they came up with, as I mentioned. You know, this thing seemed to be falling apart. This is the settlement that was supposed to take care of all of those former players who are suffering now with health problems. But, you know, Hub, from what I've been reading, age appears to be a big factor in who gets what and how much.
Yeah, there's really three major problems here, Wayne. When this was announced, it was perceived as a big deal, would settle a lot of the potential liability problems for the owners, supply some relief for the retired players. But problem number one, there was just under 1,300 players involved in the original class. Once this was announced, players started jumping on left and right, and there's no telling how big that number could get. The $765 million number doesn't go up. Problem number two, now individual players and their personal attorneys are getting a look at the details of this settlement before they actually agree to it, ratify it, execute it, whatever you want to call it. And they're finding out that for each individual player, the compensation is not that great, that you'd have to have a life-ending situation where maybe your family could get some significant money. And even in those cases, depending on the cause of death or illness, it wouldn't be as much as would need be to take care of their families. For players who have to live with some disability, again, unless it's really significant and they get the right diagnosis, they might not get the money they need. So the players aren't happy with the terms of it. And then comes problem number three, which to some is the biggest. The lawyers will get $122 million of the $765 million. Now, percentage-wise, that's not unheard of in a contingency-type lawsuit. It's actually less than the 30% that lawyers might sometimes get. But there was very little legal work done here. This was the product of just a few meetings between the two sides. There was literally less than 20 hours of negotiation. There was one mediation session, and a lot of individual players and their attorneys are just livid that the attorneys could walk away with over $120 million, Arthur.
Yeah, and, you know, I think as much as anything, this kind of epitomizes, you know, you said how this was a quick process and trying to get this settlement locked in. It obviously shows that the NFL is wanting to put this behind them and, you know, move forward. But, of course, now as we're starting to peel back some of the layers, we're finding out that maybe this isn't as sweet of a deal as we originally expected.
Yeah, and then the lawyers, of course, the billable hours, fellas, they always get theirs. We'll be back with more Way We Hear It when your current edition of Pro Football Weekly continues. You are listening to Pro Football Weekly, featuring the editor Hub Arkish with news and notes the way we hear it from across the NFL. Hub is on assignment this week. Arthur Arkish of USA Today joins us in studio. Are there a lot of calls across the league for full-time officials? I don't know how much of a difference it would make. I know that there's a tremendous amount of study and preparation that goes into every game by the officials. But, you know, this year it seemed like, as Peter King of Sports Illustrated described it, the year of the blown call across the NFL. And there's a lot of talk that maybe what the league needs to do is not only have more replay, but streamline it to the point where every questionable call would go to a headquarters location and be determined, the result would be determined there, not on the field. Talk a little bit about what you know about this and what you've heard around the league.
When, you know, the NFL is at the height of its popularity and you have so much discussion revolved around the blown calls by officials instead of these, you know, these superstars that the fans want to be focusing on, that's why all this discussion is coming up. You mentioned a few of the blown calls during the season that really decided games. I mean, we only have to go back to Week 17 in the Chargers-Chiefs, Ryan Succop's missed field goal, that there was actually an illegal formation penalty that wasn't called on the Chargers. If that penalty is called, the field goal is re-kicked from 5 yards further in. Succop probably hits it. The Chargers probably aren't in the playoffs. It would be the Pittsburgh Steelers instead if they lose that game. So it's really just these game-impacting plays that the referees seem to be missing. So there's a couple separate issues. First of all, there's only a handful of full-time officials in the NFL, and there's a strong belief around the league that there needs to be at least one head referee from every crew, from each of the 17 crews that's on a full-time basis. That allows them, of course, first of all, to have, you know, more incentive. They're getting benefits. They have more incentive to know the rule book. But more than that, in a changing NFL where the rules are changing every single year, you have to know guys are going to, you know, be comfortable with the rule book, be comfortable with the interpretation of the rules to get it right. So that's one issue. And then the other issue that you had mentioned was moving the replays to a centralized location away from the field. I think that that's a good call. I think a lot of people around the league agree for a number of reasons. For one thing, it's going to speed up the time in between these replays, being called and the actual calls on the field, being put into action. And then beyond that, it takes a little bit off the plate of the referees who are under the hood. If you have it done at a centralized location, it just gives them one less thing to worry about. It gives them a little less opportunity to screw up these calls that we're talking about. There's been so many others in the NFL this season that have really kind of left a black cloud. When, like I said, it's the height of the NFL's popularity, we should be focusing on the superstars on the field and the great teams that have been assembled.
Officiating in any major league sport, any professional sport, is a very difficult endeavor when you consider the way these sports are played, the size, the speed of the players, the impact, all of that. But, you know, I think, Arthur, what caught a lot of people were the interpretations or lack thereof in some cases of these rules. You mentioned the Ryan Succop field goal situation where San Diego had an illegal formation, an unbalanced line on that field goal try. Nobody picked up on it. There were some blown calls at the end of games where it was more, I guess you would call it paperwork type stuff. You know what I mean? Just they didn't get it right. And so I wonder if when we see those things happening, I mean, I don't know, can replay correct that, or are we getting into too much replay?
Well, I know another example that they're going to look closely at was Jeff Triplett's blown replay call of the Cincinnati Bengals Ben Jarvis Green Ellis's touchdown at the end of a game late in the season. It did go up to the booth. It was ruled not a touchdown on the field. Triplett incorrectly overruled the call. And there was another, you know, as I mentioned, I called it a black cloud earlier, but just another reason that you'd want to take a closer look at this. There's so many other instances. Everyone remembers Mike Tomlin on Thanksgiving inexcusably working his way out onto the field. There's a referee standing right there. They missed the call. So there's just a lot of instances where you would think that if you had sort of a neutral set of eyes from overhead looking on, that maybe you'd miss less of these calls. And, you know, it remains to be seen if that's going to happen. But as I said, you know, I think there's been enough examples where things have been screwed up this year that they're looking to try and, you know, take extra measures and make sure they're not putting too much on the referee's plate.
Let's get back on the coaching carousel. Minnesota Vikings still have an opening as we tape this program. Darrell Bevell, their former quarterbacks coach and offensive coordinator at Minnesota, and Ken Whisenhunt are top candidates for that job from what you hear?
Yeah, that's right. These are two of the top offensive minds, assistants in the league right now. They're going to get opportunities somewhere. Ken Whisenhunt, you'll hear his name attached to pretty much every opening available. That's because he has had some very productive offenses. If you think about it, I don't know that he has necessarily grown too many quarterbacks yet. You'll remember he did inherit Kurt Warner when he took the Cardinals to that Super Bowl, but Darrell Bevell, of course, worked with Brett Favre, had great success in Green Bay before moving on to Seattle. We've seen the, you know, the rocket-like ascent of Russell Wilson. You know the Vikings problem. Everyone knows the Vikings problem has been for some time. They have not been able to get things solved under center. These are two guys who could be able to help in that direction. It looks like they are definitely leaning offense to fill that position.
We'll have more Way We Hear It information when we continue on Pro Football Week. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. This is Wayne Larrivee along with Arthur Arkush of USA Today in studio, and we're joined by Eric Edholm of Yahoo Sports. We continue with The Way We Hear It on this divisional playoff edition of Pro Football Weekly. And guys, one of the main competitors this weekend for the Seattle Seahawks, it is Marshawn Lynch, their outstanding running back, has some disdain or reticence when it comes to the media. He's been fined $50,000, and from what I understand, he said that maybe this has been put on hold now that he's meeting with the media and talking up a storm. Eric at home, tell us what you know about that. What did you hear?
Yeah, I mean, I know when he did talk to the media the other day, I thought it was pretty unprofessional, to be honest. I mean, guys were just asking him pretty easy questions about his teammates, you know, trying to help promote them, trying to talk about the offensive line, Michael Robinson, some of the more unsung guys, and he just kind of refused to talk in the way of saying yep and one word answers and not really helping out the media. And, you know, I understand when guys don't want to talk one day here or there, but, you know, the fact that he's sort of throwing this, you know, little protest or pouting session or whatever just seems like an unnecessary distraction for a guy who could probably help them out by assisting these guys and giving them the answers they want.
It's not technically true when Marshawn Lynch went to Twitter and said that he won his appeal. Greg Aiello did release a statement saying that Ray Anderson, who of course oversees all these fines, said that he was going to hold off on the $50,000 fine. So he didn't win the appeal. He said he was going to hold off. It would be in abeyance for now because Marshawn Lynch had committed to actually starting to meet with the media. But that if he didn't comply further, then they would take that $50,000. There would be a further fine coming. It's going to be fascinating to see what the league does because, like Eric said, Marshawn did agree to meet with the media, but obviously he's still not, you know, he's giving them the minimum required, and it'll be fascinating to see if the NFL decides, well, you know what, that's not enough. You're clearly still, you know, kind of flying by the seat of your own pants here.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting that you mentioned that because, again, Eric, like you said, hey, what he's offering the media, they're getting as much out of his non-compliance as they are when he quote-unquote complies with the media requirements. And this league has been built on kind of an openness at times to the media, at least way back to the Pete Rozelle days. That was a big part of it. We'll see how they handle this. But $50,000 fine on Marshawn Lynch for not talking to the media is on appeal, apparently, and is being held in abeyance at the moment by the league.
Dennis Allen back in Oakland with $60 million in cap space for the Raiders. Will the head coach be successful? Maybe we'll now get a chance to see what the head coach can do, because quite frankly, fellas, it's been tough to get anything done in Oakland with the kind of salary cap limitations they've had in the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, they haven't had a full set of draft picks. This will be their first year they've had one in several years, and you know, no clarity at the quarterback position. I think depth problems at almost every spot. Some key free agents to sign. Yeah, they're going to have the room to do so this year, but you know, there are going to be other teams who want some of their top players, and it's just going to be very tough for them to be competitive in an AFC West that sent the three other teams to the postseason. So, you know, I do feel bad for Dennis Allen. I think he's, you know, he's coached relatively well if things fell apart a little bit at the end of the season, but with the ownership situation, the front office situation, the coaching situation, it just seems like a hot mess over there right now.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. You know, like Wayne said at the top, there is some room to maneuver. They have finally started to get out of the, you know, the basement that, frankly, Al Davis, towards the end of his, career in the NFL, kind of put them in because of some of the ill-advised contracts they handed out. They've been, Reggie McKenzie's done great work to kind of get some of that bad money off the books. Now they're in position to try and go out and lure some guys to Oakland. But like Eric said, there's not a lot of building blocks there, and there's not a lot of security for Dennis Allen, who really just found out within the past 48 hours he was going to be retained for 2014. So you got kind of, you know, a really mercurial situation with the coaching staff, and it's going to be fascinating to see. I think you know there's going to be some players who are going to have to decide between winning right away and taking the big paycheck. We've seen it go in both directions. It'll be interesting to see how Oakland fares.
Well, fellas, we talked about cap space for the Raiders. They've got a lot of it, but not everybody does, and there may be cap casualties. There always are in the NFL, and some of them are liable to be some big names like Julius Peppers and Terrell Suggs, Arthur.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to defer to Eric on this one, but I would say that, you know, my thought on this is both players who have just huge cap numbers for 2014. I believe Julius Peppers is right around $14 million. Terrell Suggs is at $12.4 million. Clearly, that doesn't line up with the production they had on the field. But to me, this traces back to the quarterback contracts. Joe Flacco, Jay Cutler are going to be commanding big, big percentages of that salary cap. And I think when you got a lot of rebuilding efforts with these defenses, the GMs have some tough decisions to make, Eric.
Yeah, right. And I think Peppers is probably not a surprise, obviously, to a lot of people based on the way his play kind of leveled off. It was inconsistent last year. And, you know, Suggs obviously is still a player who's playing at a very high level. I thought he had a great, great season for the Baltimore Ravens. So it's not as simple as setting a sixth-round pick in the Bolden trade. I mean, I don't think you can do that with Terrell Suggs. They've got to find a way to make this happen. And you've got some offensive guys, too. I mean, I think, you know, there's some big-name players, obviously Mark Sanchez we know about, but you know, Sam Bradford's the situation in St. Louis. You know, even Heath Miller in Pittsburgh. You're making a lot of money for his age and his injury history. There are quite a few big-name players who could be cut this offseason.
Stay tuned. We continue on this divisional round of the NFL playoffs on Pro Football Weekly after these messages. Welcome back to this postseason edition of Pro Football Weekly. The Saturday games in the NFL this weekend. Hub's on assignment this week. We're joined by Arthur Arkush of USA Today Sports in the studio and Eric Edholm of Yahoo Sports. Well, guys, let's begin with New Orleans 12-5, Seattle 13-3. Saints won that elusive road postseason victory, knocking off the Eagles 26-24 in Philadelphia last Saturday night. This week they get another crack at the top-seeded Seahawks. Saints fell to the Hawks in resounding fashion earlier this year, 34-7 in Seattle. Furthermore, when the Saints were the defending world champions, they lost a wild card playoff game, 41-36, in January of 2011 to a Seahawks team, Arthur, that wasn't even 500. They went into the playoffs at, 7-9 that year.
Yeah, that's right, Wayne. And everyone better get their Skittles ready, because we're going to be seeing plenty of Marshawn Lynch replays. Of course, who remember that sort of defining run for him where he broke, pretty much every tackle on the field on the way into the end zone. But I think that the game to focus on more specifically, of course, was the thumping that the Seahawks put on the Saints a handful of weeks ago. I believe it was week 14, 34-7. What's encouraging for the Saints, of course, was the way that they did get the road playoff game monkey off their back, if you will, playing so well in Philadelphia last week. And Eric, I think the fact that the New Orleans defense specifically was able to control one of the most explosive offenses in the league is going to really bode well for them as they head out to Seattle. You'll remember Russell Wilson just ran wild. You know, actually, he was very, very productive with both his arm and his legs in that first meeting between those two teams this season.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, if you look at the Seahawks offense since then, it has slowed down. I mean, this was a 28-point-per-game clipped kind of team, and I think the defense helped set a lot of that up. But they were still doing things offensively. Last four games, they've kind of slowed down. You look back to that tape, that was really the last sort of dominant game on both sides of the ball for the Seahawks. So, you know, Saints have a chance. The way they dominated the line of scrimmage in that game against the Eagles impressed me. And, you know, you had Curtis Lofton all over the place making plays. Keenan Lewis, before he got hurt, was a great cover man. I think he's going to help take Golden Tate out of the game if he's available. You know, Broderick Bunkley played well on the inside. Cameron Jordan was a beast. So all these guys up front, all of a sudden, you know, Rob Ryan doesn't have to blitz. They're used to the environment. I think they're just going to be a lot more seasoned, a lot more comfortable heading into there than they were in the first matchup.
Hey, guys, and Arthur in particular, Percy Harvin has been a story all season because he hasn't been able to get on the field. And once he did, he couldn't stay on the field. But he returned to practice this week. There's a lot of talk the Seahawks need one more dimension to their offense. Do you think he can give it to them in this playoff run?
Well, you know, I can't say it with full confidence because we've barely seen him this year. I think he played like 20, 25 snaps all season long. But it's great timing. I mean, Eric said these are almost two teams kind of heading in the opposite direction, at least the past few weeks. Seattle has not exactly had that same explosiveness on offense. If there's any guy who, when he is right, can add a level of explosiveness to any offense, it's Percy Harvin, but we'll just have to see how that hip responds. It's definitely, you know, if they're going to get him at all, now is certainly the time to try and get something back on that investment.
Meanwhile, the Indianapolis Colts at 12-5 take on the New England Patriots 12-4 in Foxborough. Colts coming off one of the greatest comebacks in NFL postseason history, Arthur, last week, rallying from 28 down in the second half to a 45-44 victory over the Kansas City Chiefs. What momentum they must feel going into Foxborough.
Yeah, just an incredibly exciting game, and really Andrew Luck's coming of age. I mean, you could say he's had a handful. You know, I mean, he's just played so well ever since he came into the league, but I think that was his actual introduction and in the fourth quarter comeback and all the heroics everywhere. Andrew Luck, T.Y. Hilton, elsewhere. You know, what I'll say on this is that defense allowed 44 points against the Chiefs and Alex Smith. Now you got to go out to Foxborough. You got to deal with Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. So I think it's going to be as much as anything on the Indianapolis Colts defense to get a little bit more accomplished to try and find a way to slow down that New England offense, Eric.
You stole my thunder. I mean, the Chiefs, Alex Smith, and no Jamal Charles. I mean, it was right. Amazing to see them roll up that kind of, you know, offensive scheme. Now, we know Robert Mathis is a one-man wrecking crew. I mean, we know what he can do. And, you know, Antoine Bethea has been a good safety in the league. I think he's played really well. Corey Redding on the other side, kind of an underrated piece. And, you know, they have good players. Jarrell Freeman, some people are making a Pro Bowl case for him. But I think that New England offense is going to be too much, and I, you know, I respect Luck's ability to make some plays. You know, the Patriots will not let T.Y. Hilton beat him like the way that Hilton beat the Chiefs last week. They'll play their second best corner over him, and they'll play a safety over the top. I think they'll do enough to slow him down. It may actually be a Aqib Talib, though, so we'll see. I mean, I'm curious to see what defense they draw up, but I can't see the Colts defense shutting down the Patriots, even as weak as they are offensively this year comparatively. For four quarters. I just can't see it happening.
No question about it. Indy has an impressive road win at Kansas City, another one at San Francisco, but this is where they're stepping to Foxborough, where the Patriots are 14-4 at home in the postseason. Stay tuned. The Sunday divisional playoff games are just ahead on Pro Football Weekly. We continue with our divisional playoff edition of Pro Football Weekly, and we bring back Hub Arkush, who is on assignment today. But one of the assignments this weekend he will have will be the San Francisco 49ers, a 13-4, at the Carolina Panthers, 12-4 in the NFC divisional playoffs. Panthers hold a 10-9 victory over the Niners in the middle of the season at San Francisco. But you guys, the question I ask here, and Arthur Arkush is with us in studio this week, you know, Arthur, are they ready to take on the Niners on a stage like this?
Well, we're going to find out. This is one of the rare instances where the home team is the underdog in the divisional round. You don't see this very often at all, but it does show kind of what you just said. I think, you know, the national audience is still wondering, is Ron Rivera ready? Is this young team ready that has, you know, really just caught fire after a rough start? So, you know, the 49ers were mighty impressive in knocking off the Packers, going into the elements and really kind of outlasting the Packers for four full quarters. Colin Kaepernick, of course, was dynamic as ever. Wasn't terrific as a passer, completed just over 50%, but did plenty with his legs. So the Panthers are going to have their hands full. Of course, it was just a few weeks back that the Panthers began to really start earning some respect with the 10-9 upset of the 49ers, in which they absolutely battered Colin Kaepernick, held him to over 100 yards passing. They're going to need a similar recipe for sure. Going to have to continually get after the quarterback to have a chance in this one.
You know, Wayne, I've never been in a situation like this. I will be on the sidelines for the national radio broadcast for Westwood One. And as you know from all of our days together in Chicago, these two head coaches, Ron Rivera and Jim Harbaugh, two of my best friends in the NFL. Ron Rivera was actually a broadcast partner of ours, worked on Bears post-game shows at WGN Radio in Chicago for 2 years before he decided to get into coaching. I can tell the national audience one thing. Ron Rivera is ready. That's not an issue. Jim Harbaugh has proven that he is ready. He took a team to the Super Bowl last year. And what's really fun about this is these two teams are so similarly constructed. They're going to pound you on defense. They're going to run the football and try and make the occasional big play through the air when they go vertical. I think the big difference is that while we don't know about Cam Newton and while there's a lot of things that Colin Kaepernick needs to learn to do better, he has played on this stage. He started the Super Bowl last year. I think a big question here, guys, could be health. How ready is Steve Smith? Because Cam Newton's got a big problem with his security. Actually, his security blanket is tight end Greg Olsen, but his big play guy in the passing game is Steve Smith. He says he's going to go. Supposedly, he's ready. He's got a knee injury, suffered 3 weeks ago, and how close to 100% he is could turn out to be the difference in this football game.
Meanwhile, Kaepernick got his big playmaker, Michael Crabtree, back. And, you know, I know he came back a couple of weeks ago, but he really came to the fore last week in Green Bay, catching passes for over 100 yards in that game, setting up some big scores for San Francisco. You know, the other question I have is the running back, Jonathan Stewart, Hub. Is his knee injury going to allow him to play? And if so, how effectively? Because I think that's a big factor in this ball game as well.
It absolutely can be. I'm not as sure about him yet as it appears that we seem to be with Steve Smith. I think the thing there, though, is that they've got D'Angelo Williams playing pretty close to 100%, and Mike Tolbert has bounced back, and you know, he's turned into like an offensive guard playing fullback, but nonetheless, he gives them a big punch in that running game. So they hope to have Stewart. That'd be one more weapon. But that's going to be a game-time decision, or at least a game-time decision or reality when we see just how close to 100% he is.
You know, Arthur, when I look at these two teams, I look at Carolina as San Francisco 2 years ago. San Francisco, in my opinion, has been the best team in the league for almost 3 years now. They need to win a Super Bowl now. They need to get it done this year because that window, despite the fact that they're very good and they're well managed by Trent Baalke, their general manager, that window doesn't stay open very long for anyone.
Yeah, we know it doesn't for any NFL team, and it's a great point. The Niners, you know, are the hottest team in football, technically winners of seven straight. So we know what they're going to bring to the table. And, you know, you make such a great comparison, Carolina, you know, looking like San Francisco a few years back. And I go back to what Hub said. I mentioned Ron Rivera, but, of course, this is Cam Newton's first taste of postseason success. So it's nice to have that defense that you can lean on, of course. But they're going to need him to go out and make some plays and win this game. One really interesting statistic when it comes to the Panthers is just how successful they are when Cam Newton runs the football. So they don't need him to just be a passer. They need him to be active with his legs to really stress the perimeters of that San Francisco defense. And really interesting stat, Carolina is undefeated 7-0 when Cam Newton runs the football at least seven times. That number drops to 3-4 when he has six runs or less. So they need him to be that dynamic playmaker inside and out of the pocket to really test that San Fran defense.
Both these quarterbacks among the league leaders in terms of quarterback rushing yardage this season. And as you saw in the final drive at Green Bay last week, when Kaepernick gets outside the pocket, that's when San Francisco's offense goes to another level. They tried to make him a pocket passer all season. He's best when he's freelancing out there on the wing and basically putting the game on himself, taking it with his legs, Hub, and that may be the difference in this one.
Yeah, it's going to have to be, I think. Again, it's got to be a big play, whether it comes from the passing game or on the legs of Newton or Kaepernick. Remains to be seen. I wouldn't look for any coaching mistakes here. The other thing, Wayne, is a big play could come from one of these defenses. And as good as Carolina has been on defense, there are more, at least better known, experienced playmakers on that San Francisco defense that is just loaded with them.
the NFC Divisional Playoff game on Sunday. Carolina playing host to San Francisco. The headliner is next on Pro Football Weekly. The headliner is an in-depth preview of the top attraction on this weekend's NFL card. Well, it is divisional playoff weekend in the NFL, and the final game of the weekend is our headliner, along with Arthur Arkush of USA Today Sports and Eric Edholm of YahooSports.com. I'm Wayne Larrabee. The San Diego Chargers 10-7 at the Denver Broncos 13-3. Now, the Chargers beat the Broncos in Denver last month 27-20. And San Diego, matter of fact, Arthur, has won six of its past eight games in Denver.
Yeah, this is a team that is really scary right now. You know, they kind of, you know, they're playing with house money, you could say. They were sort of lucky to get in the playoffs in some way. I bet the Steelers fans would put it that way. But, boy, were they impressive in beating the Bengals last week on both sides of the football. I just think, you know, defensively with Melvin Ingram and Corey Legit, you saw so many things working for them, you know, that really was an underrated unit during the season, a really good scoring defense, though they did struggle a little bit, you know, with their pass defense. So I think there's a lot of things going well, but really the focus of this has to be on offense, how well Phillip Rivers is playing, and frankly, how much success they had during the regular season against the Broncos. Every NFL head coach is going to talk about the formula for beating Peyton Manning is obviously keeping him on the sideline, you know, having a productive ball control offense, moving up and down the field. Few teams have been able to execute that as well as the San Diego Chargers were during the regular season. The time of possession numbers were just staggering, Eric.
Yeah, that was the biggest factor. I mean, you know, time of possession has to be looked at in the right perspective, right? I mean, you can't just, you know, throw that number out there and say, well, they're going to win because of it. And Ryan Matthews has to be healthy. I mean, he's become such an important factor for this team. And, you know, in that first matchup, they sent him on that left side, and King Dunlap, my goodness. I mean, I watched that game again, and I mean, he was just, you know, plowing the way for him to run. And Matthews was so effective. What, it was 129 yards, a touchdown. I thought he was really the difference. If he's not healthy, if that ankle isn't great, I see problems. I don't know if they're going to be able to extend drives the way they did with Ronnie Brown and Danny Woodhead. I mean, both guys add their pieces. But to me, it's really about Matthews being out there. I mean, we saw last week, Phillip Rivers, six first-half passes, made the most of them, and then threw in the second half. Kind of an interesting approach that may have to repeat itself. And then defensively, I mean, I thought Melvin Ingram was great. I thought Eric Weddle and Stuckey at safety were both great. Kendall Reyes, you know, I mean, they've had some pieces really step up, you know, and all of a sudden you start thinking, wow, they had Von Miller, the Broncos did for that last game. They don't now. And this is a, you know, more interesting game than people are maybe willing to see for.
Well, you know, in the first meeting, the Chargers defense came to the fore after the Broncos got off to a quick start. They took a 10-3 lead early in the second quarter. On their first two drives, they gained 122 yards and 16 plays and put 10 points on the board. On their, you know, next four possessions, all they could manage were 13 yards on 13 plays, four straight possessions, and the Chargers, meanwhile, built a 24-10 lead. So, again, you look at how that was what surprised me the most about this, because I think the mismatch in this game would be Peyton Manning and his passer rating against a Chargers secondary that yields a passer rating to its opponents of 96.4. To me, that's the mismatch in this game, Arthur, and how that plays out may be determined more than anything else who wins this game.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you, Wayne. Obviously, Peyton Manning and that Broncos versatile, you know, multidimensional offense is going to pose more problems than, although I don't give Cincinnati enough credit, it's more Andy Dalton and his failures in the postseason. But I'll tell you what, as well as their game plan has been on offense, John Pagano was pretty brilliant last week, you know, against Cincinnati. It'll be interesting to see. I think you're certainly going to see a lot more coverage. I think they're going to rely again on their front to try and create the pressure and give Peyton, you know, more things to look at, more, I should say, fewer windows to look at with more players back there in coverage. But you're right. I mean, Sharice Wright played above his head last week. That secondary has been an issue, you know, much of the season. Eric, what do you think happens this weekend?
Yeah, I'm very curious to see how that secondary holds up. And like you said, I mean, if Ingram and those guys aren't rushing and Reyes, et cetera, I mean, if they're not doing what they can do with a four-man rush, it's probably going to be pretty tough for them. I mean, yeah, you can be effective blitzing Peyton Manning, but you don't want to lean on it for four quarters. I think it's going to be so telling in the first quarter, you know, what the Broncos can do in their first two possessions. If they're up 10-0, up 14-0, I just can't see the San Diego Chargers matching points with them. I just can't see them going back and forth pinballing, because at some point they're going to have to settle for a field goal. At some point they're going to turn the ball over. You know, I just think that first quarter is probably going to be so telling. If the Broncos get the pace of the game they want, they probably win this one.
You know, guys, let's talk about the elephant in the room here. You know, and I understand Peyton Manning has won a Super Bowl and taken a team to a Super Bowl on two occasions, losing the second time to New Orleans. But so much has been made of the one-and-done playoff runs in his career. They were one-and-done a year ago. They had it all lined up much like this a year ago, and Baltimore came in there and knocked them out. How much pressure, Arthur, is on Peyton Manning, number one, but more than that, the Denver Broncos, who are built to win now?
I think there's an incredible amount. I think that Broncos fans don't really want to hear about 13-3 in a first round bye for the second straight season. It's almost as if the season starts now. I don't know if you can really, have any more pressure than that. You said it. Peyton is, he's had some struggles in the playoffs. Obviously, he's got the Super Bowl victory. He's looking for the second one, and this is as golden an opportunity as it would appear he is ever going to have.
Stay tuned. We've got the Publisher's Pen coming up next on this postseason edition of Pro Football Weekly. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. Here's this week's Publisher's Pen with Hub Arkush. Hub?
You know, and it's fascinating to me. There's been so much talk in recent years about the rules changes and what's happened in the NFL and how it's become all about offense and a passing league. And you take a look even at the early action on some of these head coaching hirings. Now, Lovie Smith is the defensive coach who's been recycled down in Tampa Bay, but the Houston Texans went out and got Bill O'Brien before anybody else could get there. Jay Gruden gets his shot in Washington. Ken Whisenhunt is the favorite for several jobs. We're still hearing about Daryl Bevel. And yet, is it really a passing league? Take a look at what's going on in the playoffs this weekend, particularly in the NFC. The number one, number two, number three, and number four scoring defenses in the NFL are the Seattle Seahawks, the Carolina Panthers, the San Francisco 49ers, and the New Orleans Saints, in that order. You still have to play defense to win championships in the NFL, and never has the difference between the two conferences been more pronounced as we look at the AFC teams, which aren't playing particularly good defense. Now, we'll get a referendum on this subject when we get to the Super Bowl, because the AFC doesn't have a great defense left to offer, but certainly in the NFC, and even when you look around the NFL going in last week with Cincinnati and Kansas City, you still have to play defense and play it really well if you're serious about winning a Super Bowl.
No question about it, Hub. Thanks very much. That'll do it for Pro Football Weekly this week. Randy Meyer is the producer-engineer of Pro Football Weekly. Pro Football Weekly originates from the studios of Syndication Networks in Chicago, Illinois. For Hub Arkush, Eric Edholm, and Arthur Arkush, this is Wayne Larrabee. We'll catch you next week for a championship week edition of Pro Football Weekly.